Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's charter school system in recent years has emerged as a laughingstock. Many called Ohio the Wild West of charter schools with little meaningful oversight and accountability. And that was the impression of charter school proponents. Last week, the Ohio General Assembly enacted a measure of reform. Ohio Governor John Kasich has said he will sign the bill into law. Coming up, we'll hear from charter critics and supporters about their impressions of the reforms. Joining us now is Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back, as always, Jim.
Good morning.
So what was wrong with Ohio's system of charter schools in the first place?
Well, how much time we got?
Yeah, I was going to say, what wasn't wrong with it?
No, that means
there are good charter schools and
right.
there are bad charter schools.
There are some good schools out there. We don't want to say that they're paint every school with the same brush.
Right.
But unfortunately, there are too many of them that are struggling. And the problem is that Ohio's oversight of these schools has not been good. The accountability for sponsors and their role in the oversight of their individual schools that they sponsor has not been good. There's been problems with conflict of interest where the sponsors are selling goods and services to their schools, and therefore there is no incentive to close them down, no matter how poor they're performing.
Making money off themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. There's been a lot of problems with transparency and disclosure in terms of how much, what's being spent, particularly by some of these for-profit operators that are hired to basically run the day-to-day operations of the schools. In many cases, these are companies where the school will get their funding and then they'll turn over 90-95% of their money over to the operator, and the operator will essentially be the de facto school. I mean, they'll basically run everything. They'll hire the personnel, run the day-to-day operations, pay the bills. And there was a lot of just conflicts there with, the operator could basically make sure the school board got appointed that they wanted. They could hire the treasurer they wanted. And so there was no one really looking over and making sure that everything was operating properly. And at the end of the day, we just have too many charter schools that are not performing at a very high standard. And even when you compare them to some of the school districts where, students are some of these, urban districts where, these charter schools were set up as a good, viable alternative for students and parents, and to give them a better choice, or at least a more secure choice. And so the concern is, we're spending $1 billion a year on this system, and the system is not producing very well. And so there's been instance after instance over the years of these concerns. There's been some studies in the last 12 months that have really highlighted some of the problems, some studies from some national groups that actually support school choice.
Right.
And so that is kind of over time kind of tipped the scales. State legislature has been very charter school friendly over the last 15 years. That has not been aided in any small part by the campaign contributions that have come from some major charter school operators. And so we ended up with a system that was badly in need of reform. And I think many school choice supporters and, frankly, school choice critics are hopeful that House Bill 2, which passed last week, is going to address many of these issues.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jim Siegel. He's a State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and we're talking about, as you know, if you've listened for the last few minutes, charter schools. It was House Bill 2. Went through the Ohio General Assembly, managed to get through a conference committee, and passed unanimously in the Ohio General Assembly, which is unusual in and of itself. It was bipartisan support for it. Everyone seemed to agree, but there were questions, Jim Siegel, about whether the measure would get through in time before the end of the year. People weren't sure. They did a lot of work very, very quickly after this summer when they came back in the fall. What changed?
Well, this bill had passed both chambers before they left for their summer break at the end of June.
But there was a conference committee.
But at that point there wasn't, which was the problem.
Okay.
The quick story is the House passed its version of the bill. The Senate made a number of changes and additions. The bill then has to come back to the House, and the House has to decide whether it's going to approve those changes or send it to conference committee. Well, House leadership wanted it to go to conference committee. And some of the bill sponsors wanted it to go to conference committee. One of the bill sponsors didn't. And frankly, if they had put it up for a conference committee vote back in June, there's a good chance it would have been approved rather than sent to conference committee. So it caused a bit of a headache. And so they just didn't vote on it at all. And so they then spent the summer working on what they felt were some issues with some of the Senate changes and some additional language that they wanted changed. At the end of the day, when they came back, they had worked it out largely during the summer. And then so they were able to work pretty quickly when they got back and passed the bill. They, you know, came out of conference committee unanimously. As you said, they I think the Senate was unanimous. There were a handful of Democrats in the House who voted against it. I think about half dozen. But frankly, on an issue of this magnitude, that's pretty broad bipartisan support. But I mean, they were under a lot of pressure to get this done. They were getting beat up very badly on the editorial pages across the state, and they were being pressured all over the place to get this done. And there was really genuine concern among supporters of this bill that somehow the forces behind the scenes who have been known to want to not really strengthen charter school laws were going to somehow weaken the bill and prevail. But that turns out that did not happen. And I, you know, there, some of the folks who were in the process have told me it's because of the pressure that's been applied, particularly by media across the state, that none of that really came to fruition.
We're going to hear later on in the program from Chad Aldis. He's vice president for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, which supports charter schools. It's a proponent, but it was also a critic of how Ohio charter schools operated. And so they're supportive of this bill. They're glad that the governor's going to sign it into law. Who isn't happy about this?
Well, no one's really coming out publicly and saying they're not happy.
Okay.
There's been, the group, the main charter school advocacy group in the state has come out in support. But we just kept hearing from folks who were in the process, hearing that there were some behind the scenes efforts to make some changes in the bill at the end that would have weakened some of the provisions. Some of the provisions, such as provisions to change sponsors when you get when one sponsor drops, you can immediately an operator immediately moves and finds a new sponsor so the school can continue to run and operate with all the same people. But you kind of avoid avoid being shut down for poor performance. And there were some concerns that there would be changes to the way that student academic progress is tracked. Mm-hmm. Some wanted a California model, which I don't know that even California is sticking with that. But it would essentially been a weaker model of tracking academic performance. Some were trying to push for that kind of thing. And there were concerns that, there was provision in the bill about requiring more reporting of operator expenditures. Now, this is something the House didn't even want. The House did not put this in their original bill. They actually made sure it didn't go in, but the Senate included it, and it basically requires these for-profit companies to disclose more of the spending that they're doing
of public money.
And so there was continued concern that was still in there. But like I said, in the end, none of those things were really changed at all, except for maybe some technical tweaking, it seems. So, and in the end, most everyone publicly, at least, seemed pleased with the bill.
I just want to be real clear. We have the kind of the bricks and mortar or the online bricks and mortar schools. The schools, the place where the teachers are that kids go to learn.
Well, there's no online bricks and mortar. Brick and mortar.
That's an oxymoron. Right. But I guess there's a place where there are teachers that are reviewing the kids' work. There's where the teachers are.
Right.
Okay. And then there is the operator.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have an operator, do you? Don't you have to have a sponsor?
You have to have a sponsor. You do not have to have an operator.
Where do they?
But many schools do.
Because.
Many of the sponsors are not equipped to really run the day-to-day operations of these schools. I believe that's the reason.
And a sponsor could be a public school district.
A public school.
It could
yes.
be something like Ohio Dominican University, which has a really highly regarded charter operation. It could be a church.
It can be a church. There is an orphanages okay. have sponsored schools in Ohio. There have been all kinds of, let's just call them interesting groups that have stepped up and sponsored schools.
Name
off,
one
off
interesting.
And on. Well, the orphanages are some.
Yeah, that's...
why would an orphanage get involved in this? Well, sponsors get 3% of the funding from a charter school. So a charter school, you know, charter school gets $1 million. Well, 3% of that goes to the sponsor. So the sponsor, you know, supposedly so the sponsor can perform its duties as sponsor. Well, some of the concern has been, and one of the changes in this bill is going to require a little more, it's tightening up what the sponsors are allowed to spend that money on. The concern has been is that they basically just took this 3%, used it to subsidize whatever they did before, you know, subsidize their normal business operations. If you're an orphanage, you obviously to run your orphanage. And then the concern was that that was money was not really being spent on the school. And then the sponsor would then turn over all active duties on the day-to-day operation over to this operator, and the operators would be the ones that would actually run the thing. And there was, and I think this bill will start to put more of that responsibility on the sponsor, more transparency on the operator, and just generally give the public a little more sense that these things are being run on the up and up, and that you know, money isn't just flying into somebody's pocket or going to areas that are not intended. I mean, the school funding is not intended to subsidize people or organizations to do other things. It's just not how it's supposed to work.
And also, there are for-profit operators and not-for-profit operators.
Correct.
And there's for-profit sponsors and not-for-profit sponsors? No.
No, I think all the sponsors are non-profit.
Non-profit.
Yeah, yes.
Okay. So take something like the big online schools, ECOT.
Yes.
Tell us about that. That's a for-profit.
It's a for-profit operator runs that school. Now they do have a non-profit sponsor, and I just don't have the name off the top. I'm sure Chad later can tell you the names of who's involved in that,
okay.
But I don't recall the names of the sponsors or the operators. But it's, you know, but it's a gentleman by the name of Bill Lager, is basically founded the schools and runs the schools through his company, which is, I believe, IQ Innovations and some other companies. I mean, he sells the software to the school and runs the school, and so yeah, that's. I mean, that's kind of how
that's trying to give listeners an idea of how the different manifestations of charters in the state of Ohio. There's a lot of variety, a lot of differences.
Yeah, a number of educational service centers too. Some educational service centers also sponsor charter schools as well. Actually, some of those that have really gotten in trouble lately have been educational service center.
And why is that?
Sponsor. I don't know. I don't know why that is, but it just has been lately.
I guess in some ways it's sort of like running a school is harder than people think. The whole idea
I don't know who thinks
charters,
running a school's easy, but,
I don't know
but
either,
apparently some people do
that,
when they open
that
these things up.
Back when they were debating these issues 20 years ago in the Ohio General Assembly, the idea was, the fundamental idea was someone else can do a better job. Public schools aren't doing a good enough job. They need competition.
Right. Yeah, the idea was competition would raise everybody up and that, you know, these schools would be, you know, places where innovation could flourish and you know, great things could happen, and we could really figure out better ways to teach kids that historically we've had a lot of trouble getting through to in different socioeconomic sectors. And so, but it just, I mean, like I said, some schools are doing that. Some schools are showing definite progress, but a number of schools are not. And that's been part of the ongoing concern that, you know, choice for the sake of choice is not really enough of a reason to, I think, to spend $1 billion a year on a system. The people looking at this, including those who support choice, say, look, there needs to be value to that. You know, we can't just fool parents into thinking that because we have this massive charter school system that it's automatically a better way to go. We need to actually show performance. And I think that's what they're hoping we're going to start to see with with House Bill 2. And I think the folks later can talk more about this as well. But I think the big question now is one of the big questions is what's the Department of Education going to do?
Right.
Because they're going to be heavily involved in some of this. And there's just, there's some concern that, you know, do they have the staffing? Do they have the expertise? Do they, you know, their top charter school person had to resign about 6 weeks ago because he got caught up in a scandal where he was illegally excluding online charter schools from sponsor evaluations. And so,
made the overall system look much more successful.
Right. So it's things like that that make people go, well, we really need to make sure that the Department of Education is on the ball and ready to take this on.
We're talking about charter school today, a big reform measure moved through the Ohio General Assembly. The governor has said that he will sign it. We're talking with Jim Siegel. He's from the Columbus Dispatch, who's been covering the issue. Coming up, we're going to hear from proponents and critics of the charter school system, all of whom are glad for these reforms. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The governor said that he will sign into law a bill that ushers in some 30 new regulations for Ohio's system of publicly financed, privately operated charter schools. Still with us is Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Joining us now is Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, Chad Aldis. Welcome back, Chad.
Thank you for having me.
And Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio, Stephen Dyer. Welcome back, Stephen.
Good to be back, Ann.
Okay, so, we're not going to get to everything, so let's start with what do we think is the most important? The measure covers charter school finances, performance measures, and governance. Let's talk about governance. What were the big changes? What really mattered to you, Chad Aldis?
Yeah, the governance reforms in this legislation were pretty monumental, quite honestly. And charter schools, as you talked about in your first segment, have lots of different layers. The initial layer is the governing board that runs the school. The governing board in this was empowered and made much more independent than had been previously the case in Ohio.
What was it like before and how did it change?
Yeah, well, previously, governing boards were often sort of just a placeholder for others who wanted to do what they wanted to many times with the school. What this measure does is it ensures that the governing boards hire their own attorneys to negotiate contracts with an operator or with a sponsor. It ensures they have an independent accountant slash auditor if that's needed by the school. It requires board members to fill out conflict of interest statements. There's probably three or four other just common sense reforms that are necessary to make sure that when a board member actually provides oversight to a school and makes decisions regarding the school, they're doing it for the interest of the students and the school and not on behalf of an operator or a sponsor or anyone else that might be a party to the overall work.
Aren't these some of the things, though? This is all going to cost money and charter schools are going to have to pay for that. Isn't it going to come out of the school desks of the in the classrooms?
You know, I think that was a big concern going into this. No one knew what charter school reform would look like. I think if you go through the provisions of the bill, not only the ones I just described, but a lot of others, most of them are not going to cost additional dollars at the classroom level.
Anytime you hire an attorney, it costs more money. Come on.
Well, it doesn't require them to hire it, but when they need to hire one for a contract, if they need an attorney for that, then they will have to pay for that. But I'm actually thinking about all of the other reforms that people thought would actually would get into the school operations. They didn't do that. They reset Ohio's governance structure, which was largely in need of a reset, and that's a step forward without getting into the individual business of operating schools.
Stephen Dyer, from where you sit, what about the governance changes?
Well, I think the governance changes were, frankly, you know, common sense, like Chad said. But, you know, what it points out is just how far we had to come. The fact that, now you're not going to have boards that are handpicked by operators anymore. I mean, that's
to rubber stamp, you know, whatever
rubber
the
stamp,
operator.
I mean, why we've been doing that for 16 years is, you know, incredibly frustrating. But it's nice that that this reform happened. I mean, I think the most important thing that changed with the House Bill 2 is the recognition that there's a problem, and having. You know, there are changes on governance, there are changes on accountability, there are changes on transparency. The department's actually going to keep track of who runs, you know, which operators are running which schools and rate them. I mean, you know, this is all stuff that probably should have been done a long time ago. I'm glad it's being done now. But again, we've had an entire generation of kids go through this the system that, you know, has been nationally ridiculed. But I am glad that we're turning the corner and we're at least on the path toward respectability.
It's certainly something, the way the system's been operating, is something that Innovation Ohio has criticized for a long time. What do you think was the trigger? What do you think did change? The kind of the national disdain for the system, embarrassment by state?
I think it was, you know, folks like Chad and others in the charter sector who said enough's enough, and you know we need to start
the good guys
worrying about,
in the charter sector.
Well, yeah, we need to stand up for quality, and the idea of quality choice rather than choice for choice's sake, I think, is what won the day on House Bill 2. And you know, I'm glad that we're now having a discussion about that. I think you can tell a lot about a charter sector by kind of the lawsuits that are filed. And, you know, it's interesting that in Massachusetts there's a lawsuit right now being filed by parents and children of who can't get into charter schools because the charter schools there are so highly regarded. They're saying it's a civil right for me to get access to the charter school. Our lawsuit that we just settled was about whether the operator gets to hold the charter school board essentially hostage over the property that they just bought. And we said, yeah, they did. Now this bill changes that. But I think that it'll be a great day for choice in Ohio when parents are saying, you know, it's our civil right to be able to access charter schools in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And right now we don't have that. But I think that mm-hmm. this puts us on the path to respectability.
In other words, a civil right akin to it's my yeah. civil right to send my kid to a public school.
Right. It's
gotcha.
The state has an obligation to provide more seats in high quality charter schools. That's not the lawsuit we have here, but I'm hoping that in some point, you know, there's going to be a clamoring for that because that means we have a healthy sector.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Jim Siegel.
Well, you know, you mentioned what changed and kind of prompted this. I don't think there's any way to kind of overstate just how big of a deal it was that this even got done. I mean, if you sat at this around the State House and observed the charter school debates over the last 15 years, you would have never thought that the two parties could have come together around a reform bill like this. They've been knocked down, drag out fights. There's been a coming around. The Democrats have come around a bit on choice and starting to realize that there could be some value in it. And frankly, they're coming around to realizing that with Republican control, that it's just not going away, and it's now too big to really just toss out. And Republicans have came around to the idea that look, this isn't. You know, there are problems that we need to fix. And I think Steve was right in that, you know, when your friends start telling you there's a problem, that's when things start to change. When Chad Aldis and folks who are deeply into the school choice movement start coming up and saying, look, this system is lousy and needs, you know, some major overhauls. That's when folks start to pay more attention. I think that really got people going and particularly like, you know, Senator Peggy Lehner and others who really started to take some initiative on this, and even Governor Kasich to a certain degree.
Very unusual for him to say he's going to sign a bill before he signs it, that he tells us what he's going to do. This is one of those unusual moments. One issue that emerged nationally, Chad Aldis, and I wonder, you know, you and I have talked about it before, and that is the issue of profit versus not-for-profit. In some states, they're not allowed to be able to sell education for profit. It has to be nonprofit. Is that part of a fundamental problem in Ohio, or does it work well in other states?
You know, I think that's an easy answer that we actually all want to turn to because it just strikes us.
To explain?
Yeah, we have a visceral response to the idea of for-profit. And, you know, public school districts do, of course, do business with for-profit companies all the time, from textbook makers to student transportation services and others. Mm-hmm. But I think what we saw in Ohio was a little bit different in that the for-profit companies, in many cases, had like complete turnkey control over some of the schools and institutions. We wouldn't be answering this question if the academic performance of Ohio's charter schools, especially those managed in that fashion, was high. in general, we'd be fine. Really, this question gets posed because of the academic struggles. At the end of the day, I think House Bill 2 and the changes the legislature made will go a long way toward making sure that we have the information necessary to know if that is really what's driving it, whether it's the profit motive, whether it's that sort of incentive that's leading to low performance. Specifically, the biggest change put in was one recommended by Auditor Yost, and that is a detailed financial accounting of what the operator expends.
Transparency.
That's right. And it was overdue. And going forward, it's going to make for interesting reading for people like Stephen and others as we look to make sure these dollars are being spent appropriately.
Stephen Dyer, do you think that there'll be some kind of natural, I don't know, entropy or something of the for-profit model?
Well again, I'm kind of in a weird position because in House Bill 1 back in 2009 when I was chairman of the Primary Secondary Education Subcommittee, then Governor Strickland actually struck out the idea that you could have for-profit operators.
What do you mean struck out?
I mean, he said you couldn't do it anymore. You know,
okay.
He brought us in line with other states to say you can't do it. I put it back in.
okay.
But I think
uncomfortable
I think,
pause.
So, yeah.
Why did you do that? Why you didn't think it was a problem?
Well, but I just don't. Again, I'm kind of the feeling that you know I would like people who are able to figure out a way to effectively educate children, I don't think it's a bad idea for them to profit from that. I mean, you know, I would rather see them get money than say, you know, not that I don't love LeBron, but,
yeah.
You know, I like that idea. I think the evidence that the profit motive improves student achievement is very sketchy at best at this point.
Okay.
But I do, you know, I'm open to all possibilities, and I'm hoping that it drives some success. Right here in Ohio, it has not done that. It's mainly driven profit. But I think if you have a strong regime in place, that you know there could be a potential. For that. But again, right now, the evidence that it improves student achievement is very sketchy. And, you know, I think we need to, you know, keep a close eye on that.
Let's talk about charter school finances and what the big changes were in that. Or are they also linked that it's hard to separate them? So that we got finances, we've been talking about performance measures and governance. Performance measures are another category. But what about finances? Remember, this is public money that we're talking about that's managed outside of the public realm. Chad Aldis.
Yeah, thank you. I would say that the primary finance revisions in House Bill 2, we've probably already talked about in terms of the operator's financial disclosure.
So it's about that transparency again.
Because charter schools are already audited. The auditor of state already does an audit of charter schools every year. The problem was sometimes that a lot of things that money, if money was turned over in mass to the operator, sometimes the money was essentially off the books. So it was hard to see. But the one thing I would add, though, related to finance-related reform that was in House Bill 2 relates to sponsors. In your first segment, there was a small talk, small mention about how sponsors spend the dollars they receive, that 3%
mm-hmm.
that
right.
they're able to bring in. Well, what House Bill 2 does is it requires them to disclose in full detail how those dollars are spent. So for the first time, all of a sudden, if you're using it for other services and not using it to provide oversight to charter schools.
It's going to your bottom line to spend as you.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
All of a sudden, we'll know that. So we'll know if sponsors are in the business for the wrong reasons.
But there's no law again. Let's say hypothetically the sponsor takes that 3% and spends it on carpet cleaning in the mother building. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that, right, Stephen Dyer? I mean,
right. I mean, again,
we'll just know about it.
Right, we'll just know about it, and hopefully the shame will bring them around. Again, when you open up sponsorship, no offense to Chad, but when you open up sponsorship to nonprofits rather than, you know, most states, it's just departments of education or school districts.
Okay.
When you open it up to nonprofits, there is a danger that they will be supplementing their other operations with funds that are meant to educate children. So, you know, there might be – it'll be more transparent about what's going on. But again, that doesn't mean that these sponsors won't be able to, you know, sponsor schools anymore.
Yeah.
Well, there's a new. There's also some new sponsor ratings in this bill that we have sponsor ratings now. This adds to it. I think there's it adds a new bottom rating. I think of poor, and basically says if you're a poor, if you get rated poor as a sponsor, you can't sponsor schools anymore. If you're rated ineffective, which is the third out of the four ratings, I think if you're rated ineffective, I think it's 3 years in a row, then you are, you're out of the game. And there's some other sanctions in there as well related to some of that. And I think there's also some there's some benefits if you're at the top of the scale too as well. So
more money. What other benefit is there?
Chad knows because I'm sure he's looking forward to it.
You can open as many charters as you want, and you get some more regulations lifted from you. I mean, they're trying to incentivize success and punish failure. I mean, is kind of the new thing. I mean, but of course the 800-pound gorilla in the room is whether the Department of Education right. will come up with effective sponsor evaluations. And, frankly, there are three areas that sponsors are evaluated on. It's just not just academic performance of their schools, but it's also adherence to the new quality standards that have been adopted that were basically the national associations. And then the other is making sure they're adhering to the rules. If they get A's in those two and they fail on the academics, they get two A's and an F, that averages out to a B minus. There are some lingering concerns about that overall evaluation, but at least we have an evaluation in place. At least we can tinker with it if we need to. And, we're in a whole lot better place than we were, a week ago.
And Ohio has never done a education evaluation system of any kind that doesn't get changed regularly.
Yes.
So I guarantee you this will get tinkered with just because they can't help themselves.
So we have these parallel universes then. We have the regular public schools, and then we have the charter schools, and we have two different sets of evaluation processes and so forth, which gets to the point that all of you have made now that can the Department of Education handle this? We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The governor said he'll sign into law a bill that ushers in some 30 new regulations for Ohio's system of publicly financed, privately operated charter schools. We've been talking about House Bill 2 and Ohio's charter schools, where they're at now and where they're headed in the future with this these new regulations. Still with us is Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel and Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, Chad Aldis. The Fordham Institute, by the way, is a big charter school proponent. It was also a critic of the previous or the still existing system in Ohio. And Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio, Stephen Dyer. Welcome to all. If you have a question or comment, now's the time. Don't wait. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about that overall evaluation. The Ohio Department of Education is to publish an annual performance report of charter schools starting next summer. Maybe I, just covered all this kind of stuff for too many years. My first question is, well, who's going to pay for that? It takes people to do these evaluation reports. It takes planning. I mean, how are they – is there funding in this measure, Jim Siegel, to pay to expand the Ohio Department of Education?
No.
Okay. So – and this is supposed to be done by next summer.
Well, House Bill 64, the budget, did have additional money for the Office of Quality School Choice at the department.
But
now, that was anticipating that this charter reform would pass in the summer. It didn't, but that money should still be there.
And how much? Do you know?
I don't remember what it
okay.
was. I do remember they'd ask for a significant improvement, and when it all shook out, they did get additional dollars.
And it
which
was in
is
anticipation
necessary.
Of the reforms?
Yes.
Absolutely, because otherwise they're just –
Well, there's a tremendous amount of work going on. And, you know, we're all sort of excited, and I think rightfully so, looking at these reforms. But these reforms will not mean much of anything if they're not properly implemented by the Department of Education.
Right. Now, who's in charge now? David Hansen resigned after it found out he was monkeying with the performance data for for-profit online schools to affect the overall output. You know, the overall grading of charter schools in Ohio, which, by the way, because of that, won a $71 million grant from the federal government, which is a whole nother issue that people need to talk about and that I hope we can squeeze in some time to talk about. But who's running the show over there right now? Do we know, Stephen Dyer?
Well, they have a charter school director that was under Hansen, who I assume would continue to do her duties. But again, this also points to a troubling habit that Ohio has had, which is increasing accountability, not just in charters but in all segments of education, without accompanying resources to properly implement it.
So you're not comfortable with the amount that was set aside in the budget?
Well, you know, it's a nice start, but I do think we need to see how this is going to work out, what they need. We need to ensure that the department has what they need to do their job effectively. And will this additional funding in the budget be enough? You know, we'll see. But again, you know, this is, you know, when you look back at, you know, the history of school funding and reform in Ohio, and, you know, I don't know if you remember back after the first Rolfe case when they decided to put the sales tax on and put in the new accountability system. You know, the sales tax didn't pass, but we kept the new accountability system. So it was, you know, this unfunded mandate issue is something that Ohio has struggled with mightily in the education sector for years. And I'm hoping that there is enough funding for the department to do its job effectively. But we'll see.
Jim Siegel?
Well, one issue actually I can continue – I've even heard about this week again as a lingering issue from House Bill 2 is on the sponsor evaluations and how are – the online school is going to be counted in those. Whether they're going to be counted as a single school, is ECOT going to be one school on the sponsors list, or is it going to be 15,000 students on the sponsors list? Mm-hmm. Now, I believe, and maybe, you know, I'm sure Chad can tell me if I'm wrong, I believe the intent, at least from what I was told by folks working on the bill, at least on the Senate side, that the intent was to have it count as the students so that ECOT would not be weighted the same as a charter school with 100 kids. They would actually count as 15,000. I'm starting to hear that there may be some trying to dispute that that's not, in fact, the way it's going to work. And I just don't know. Maybe Chad can talk about
Chad,
that.
Yeah, Chad, all this – well, what are the pros and cons of the 15,000 versus the one?
Yeah. Well, and that actually goes right to the heart of the David Hansen situation.
In the Ohio Department of Education.
So I think looking at the evaluations and the academic performance, Mr. Hansen looked at it and says, if I count this as 15,000 students, then it becomes like one-third or 40% of a sponsor's portfolio when that sponsor has 58 schools. And is that really reflective of how good a job they're doing looking over all of their schools? Conversely, if you count it as one school, you have 15,000 students counting as 1/58, so less than 2% of a charter sponsor's evaluation. Actually, I think the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle. I'm hoping this new evaluation committee the Department of Education has named will end up finding a way to have a sort of hybrid approach. So we don't say that it's purely a student count, but we find a way to try to have strike a balance in between. So we really get a measure of whether the school's doing a good job, the sponsor is doing a good job overseeing its portfolio or not. But Jim's exactly right. There is definitely two legislative readings that I'm hearing about in terms of what this really means. And hopefully cooler heads will prevail and we'll find the sweet spot in the middle that will hopefully lead to much better oversight.
But we're depending on this committee that's been appointed.
At the end of the day, the department, in my reading of it, still has to come up with this evaluation framework. The legislative language is mere guidance. Mm-hmm. So when this framework is put in place by the sponsor evaluation group, I think the department has some latitude, and hopefully they use it wisely.
And Chad, I'm just wondering, if they do count it as 15,000 students, who is ever going to be able to sponsor ECOT? I mean, it would seem like ECOT would be unable to get a sponsor.
It would be incredibly challenging depending on, as Steve mentioned earlier, how the academic accountability portion of a sponsor evaluation is weighted compared to following the rules and law, and compared to following best practices. So depending on how each of those three factors are sort of weighted in, then that will be the determining factor. But the other thing is, though, the value-added grade is what matters. And if the value-added grades improve for ECOT, if the student performance improves, then they'll be just fine.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't want to make it sound like there was nothing ECOT could do about it. Or, you know, they could improve their scores, but I'm just saying,
it would be nice.
As it stands right now, it just seems they would have a lot of trouble finding
every kid that goes from Youngstown, who, you know, we deem as so academically struggling, we need to have a state takeover of them. Every kid that goes from the Youngstown district to ECOT goes to a worse performing school. So, I mean, you know, again, ECOT is a serious issue. It's $100 million. They get all Fs and a D on the state report card. They graduate 35% of their kids. And yet, you know, the governor actually spoke at one of their graduation ceremonies. I mean, it's a concern. And, you know, the online schools, especially in Ohio, are concerned. You know, I think people are recognizing that too.
There's a national report coming out later this month by Credo, the research unit from Stanford University, that will be looking at the performance of online schools from state to state to state. So the online schools can make a pretty convincing argument that they are fundamentally different in a number of ways with the students they serve than other charter schools and other district schools. So far, we haven't had the data to really look at that and say whether that holds water. I think there's certainly reasons for skepticism. However, this data, looking at online schools from state to state, should give us a good indication whether Ohio charter schools are online charter schools are performing differently than those in other states, and should have some very valuable information on it going forward.
An email from Mark and Blacklick asks us, you know, wants you to answer these questions. Is ECOT the largest school in Ohio? It is, right? It's the largest charter school in Ohio. It's the largest school in Ohio.
It's the largest for-profit school in the nation.
Okay.
Let alone Ohio.
And Bill Luger, the owner of ECOT, gets $100 million a year to operate the system.
The school gets $100 million. I don't know what the Altair contract is. I think it's, what, 25, 30%?
Okay.
But
okay.
Yeah. So he's the operator of ECOT.
And he gets a percentage.
You know, Altair gets a percentage, but I think he also owns the software that they use. So I'm sure, you know, Acuity gets some money too.
Right. ECOT stands for Education.
Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow.
Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. I knew the OT, but I couldn't.
It was actually the state's first electronic virtual school. And interestingly, it was one of the only schools originally that was turned down for sponsorship by the Department of Education back when they were sponsoring. You know, they accepted everything. Mm-hmm. They turned them down because they weren't sure that that they could actually keep track of their kids. So ECOT went sponsor hopping and went to then the Lucas County ESC, which is now Lake Erie West, and got sponsored. And within a year, they were cited by the auditor of state, then I think it was Petro, who said that, you know, you couldn't account for about $1.2 million of kids. So,
and yet the money kept going to ECOT over the years because there was nothing in place to stop the state from doing that?
Right.
Yeah, and part of it goes into our lack of a real sponsor accountability over the years. Up until the last probably 2 years, the sponsor oversight was hit or miss. There were great sponsors out there, and there were sponsors who were either in it for the wrong reasons or just didn't know what they were doing. And this legislation, combined with legislation from a couple of years ago, does a lot to, I think, try to correct that sponsor oversight, which is critical to successful charter schools.
Michael in Bexley, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Well, hi. Yeah, the question I have, I wanted to find out about that. I'm not sure what his title was. He was in the state education department, and he changed.
David Hansen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he changed the grades.
Right. Well, he didn't change him. He just
ignored him.
He had ignored him. He just kind of scrubbed him from the final report.
Yeah, so the question I have is that, is he liable for any prosecution or anything? Because what happened in Columbus when they changed grades, mm-hmm. the people, you know.
Yeah, it was a big, big,
right.
big,
so him, hairy deal. I don't know that I don't see any, you know, what's happening with him. You know, why is he off the hook?
Jim Siegel, what's going on with that?
Well, there, I've heard no one talking about any kind of prosecution, and some have been critical of that. And they've mentioned they're trying to make a parallel comparison to what happened in Columbus with the data scrubbing there. But I
think it's hard to make a parallel with it. What he did, but why is it a question? Why isn't there some process to? Otherwise, ostensibly, couldn't somebody come in and do the same thing he did and walk away and nobody would care?
Well, I don't know if nobody would care, but and frankly, House Bill 2 kind of tries to clarify some of this as
that
well.
You can't do that.
You can't do what he did. There have Democrats, including a number of Democrats on the school board, have called for an independent investigation. The state superintendent Dick Ross and Governor Kasich have thus far rejected that.
Right.
Auditor Yost is looking into it, although even he's having some trouble getting some documents. So there's going to be some investigating, but I don't know. I don't know that everyone's going to be satisfied in the end that it's enough.
And this is close to David Hansen is the spouse of the campaign manager for the Kasich campaign. This is close. I mean, these are close connections with the governor.
Sure. Yeah. And the superintendent is, basically came out of the Kasich administration as well. I mean, he was hired by the school board, but it was basically on the governor's recommendation.
You know, there's an important point to make here, though, because we're sitting here, everyone is looking at what happened in the situation and saying it shouldn't have happened. And I think that's unanimous. But what people need to look at is the office Mr. Hansen led over the last 2 years. The Department of Education in the last 2 years has done more to pressure bad schools to close, to put the clamps down on poor authorizers or sponsors and letting them know that if they continue in this, they're not going to be allowed to continue in business. For the first time in my memory, and I mean, they have made some administrative changes that are significant and shouldn't be overlooked. So it doesn't excuse anything or bad decisions, but there hasn't been an effort in the department to overlook accountability. In fact, I'd say the data situation we're talking about, at least in the last 2 years, is the exception, not the rule.
But the data from that was take you know the what he produced from ignoring that data led to a $71 million grant from the federal government. And a lot of people are wondering, well, what do we do with this now? There are some who are concerned that the intention is to take over Youngstown schools with that money, that it was written – the grant proposal was written to do that. Steve Dyer?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's some reporting going on from the Akron Beacon Journal
right.
That suggests that actually, you know, that at the time that Hansen was applying for this is his wife was actually meeting with folks in Youngstown to talk about, you know, what to do in Youngstown. So, I mean, again, I don't – you know, the $71 million is a real head-scratcher, you know, because two days before they filed the application, what Hansen did was called illegal by members of the Board of Education. And within 2 days after the application, evaluations were rescinded by Ross. So – and there's no indication in the application at all that something was going on.
Right.
There's some concern about –
they don't read papers in Washington,
right. There's some concern about that application.
Yeah.
But, you know, beyond that concern, there's also concern about the administration of it. Again, reiterating the issue that we've all been talking about is, you know, can ODE effectively administer that $71 million? Mm-hmm. Can they get their act together? If they don't, then all this good work that we've been doing over the last 2 years will go for naught.
That's it for today. Steve Dyer, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
Stephen Dyer, he's Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio. Chad Aldis, as always, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Chad Aldis, he's Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. And Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch, Thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, Allside's interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is Allside's with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.